This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress. She makes cave suits. She's a small one-person business based in Philadelphia, and she's a wizard with the sewing machine. She started off making leggings and some other things and expanded from there. And when she started caving, she was looking for cave suits. And, you know, there's a few things out there, most of them pretty decent, but not a whole lot to choose from, let's be honest. So she decided to make some of her own. And her cave suits, man, she knows what she's doing. She makes them from 500 denier Cordura all over and then twice as thick where it counts. Elbows, in the knees, you know, your butt, where you need some extra reinforcement. Lots of colors to choose from. That's another thing about the other cave suits that are on the market. There are a few colors, but Sophie's got a lot of colors to choose from. And she'll start you off with a basic suit, or you can do custom add-ons like extra pockets, inside pockets, knee pad pockets. If you want to just slip your knee pads right in there, or bat stencils, wherever you want. And everything's made to order just for you, like I said. You can find her at SophieReaptress.com. I've got a link in the description of this podcast. You can also find her on Instagram at SophieReaptress. And if you're wondering which one is hers, hers is the one with like 30,000 followers. It's ridiculous. Sophie Reaptress, get you a custom cave suit. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser. I am former chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. I'm just a member now. But if you have ever thought about getting into caving leadership, I would highly, highly encourage it. If your grotto puts on an annual event, that's an awful lot to do. If you don't put on an annual event, there's still an awful lot to do. And all of the people who have been heavily involved in the grotto will appreciate your putting in the time to lead the grotto in one form or another. So get on the board and your caving community will thank you. If you're here for the first time, if you're here because you're interested in caving and haven't done it before, welcome. I'm so excited that you want to do that. The only thing is you've got to do it the right way. You've got to go about it the right way, because caving is like a lot of things. It can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And the opposite of that, once you do know what you're doing, and it's just something that it's very important that you know the safety protocols going into it. So get in touch with your local grotto. You don't have to join right away, but at least make some friends. And I've got a link in the description of this podcast to the NSS website, the National Speleological Society website, that will allow you to find your local grotto and get in touch with the leadership. I'm really excited for this episode. This was such a cool experience and such a great talk that I primarily had with Justin Huffman. And if you're a Tennessee caver and you've heard his name, you've probably heard what he has done, and we will definitely get to that in just a moment. This was recorded over the Syrah Cave Fair weekend, which was just wonderful. Thank you to Alan Hatcher and everybody out there who I hung out with. Gosh, I got to put a face to so many names of so many people that I've just interviewed for the podcast or have arranged to interview for the podcast. We haven't quite done it yet. It was just so cool to meet all these people. I was asked while I was there to host the door prize portion of the Saturday night, which was fun. And the Cave Rats, the band, they were great. They even they played a request toward the end of their set. By that time, I was already in my tent because I had to leave early on Sunday. And I heard them play Good by Better Than Ezra. And I thought about throwing my shoes back on and running out and giving them a standing ovation just because, yeah, I love that song. And I thought it was cool that they played a request. Were able to pull that off. Anyway, they were fun to watch. Everybody there was so nice. I'd shout out everybody by name, but it was a long weekend, and I don't want to forget anybody. If I saw you and we hung out, it was great hanging out, and I hope to be back for Syrah again someday. I hope you had a good time at Speleo Fest. That just wrapped up. I wasn't able to make it, but man, I had a good time a couple of years ago when I went. A quick calendar note, NSS convention happening in Elkins, West Virginia, June 26th through the 30th. I won't be able to make it, I'm sorry to say, but you should really consider going. What a great place to have it. You can just Google NSS Convention 2023. You'll be able to find it and have the best time. One thing I will be at is Indiana Cave Capers, first weekend in August. That's the annual event that my grotto puts on. You can pre-register. I've got a link to the Indiana Cave Capers website in the description of this podcast right now. Fistful of Tacos, providing the banquet at the Harrison County Fairgrounds near downtown Corydon, pretty much in downtown Corydon. And again, you can pre-register at the link that I've included in the description of this podcast. So yeah, this was a great trip. This was a trip that I was invited on by Corey Ellis, who I've been corresponding with via Instagram and email leading up to Sarah. And he brought along Aaliyah Moore, who was a delight to meet and go caving with, and Justin Huffman, who, again, was who I spoke with most for this interview because he has done something really incredible in finding 500 new caves in a year. Just an incredible feat. But as you'll hear, he's very methodical about it. I like the way Justin operates. I admire it. And it was really an honor to talk to him about it. And as you'll kind of hear at the top, it seemed like we kind of tricked him into it because Corey and I had kind of talked about Justin prior to this trip. And he's like, yeah, I mean, if we could get him talking about that, that'd be pretty cool. And it did seem to Justin like it was a conspiracy to get him to talk about this thing. But it really just kind of happened organically. And then, you know, once it started happening, I kind of leaned into it. So we talk about his efforts in Tennessee, and then we talk later about his trip to Alaska where he found some stuff. And then we kind of briefly get into his caving genesis. Oh, and there are some audio issues when I was, especially during the Alaska portion. I think I had my cell phone too close to the recorder or something like that. And so that's what's going on later. It shouldn't be too distracting, but there's the explanation. And I'll share some abridged audio of the trip itself, which was just a bounce of Conley Hole in Tennessee, a cave that I've been to before that I loved and leapt at an opportunity to return to, especially with such good company as Justin, Aaliyah, and Corey. So here we go. Let's get to it. It's the trip. It's the trip to the cave, man. Hey, Corey, where are we going?
I believe we're going to a cave called Conley Hole.
I've been to Conley Hole. Have you ever been to Conley Hole?
This will be my first time.
Anybody else in here been to Conley Hole yet? Am I the only one?
Yeah.
I'm the out-of-towner's the only one. Yeah. I'm anomalous among cavers in that I really don't mind going to the same place over and over and over again. Is there a cave like that for you, Corey?
That I don't mind going over and over again to?
Yeah.
I prefer to go to a different cave, but at least a different spot in the same cave if I'm going to the same cave twice.
Well, okay. Is there one that you wouldn't mind going back to the same cave, same spot? Same objective?
I mean, you know, I prefer not to, but we were originally going to take a trip to Blue Spring to go to an area called Silent Hall in the back of it, but we realized it probably was just a bit of too of a long trip for a cave party weekend to be able to do that and get back at a reasonable hour, but that's a great one to revisit.
So you've been there before?
To that part of the cave, yeah. I've been to that cave 10 times now.
Well, yeah, but that's a huge cave, so that doesn't really count, though,
yeah,
does it?
Every time I've been to a different part of the cave, so never really gone back just to go to the same area twice, but
we were emailing about that one, and that got me so excited because I've been wanting to do like a long trip, like another good long trip. I haven't done a long trip in years, and that one got me going. I'm in better shape now than I was then when I did that long trip, so I felt like I could do it. But then you were like, yeah, it'd be a leave first thing and get back after everybody's gone to bed kind of thing. And I was like, I don't know if I can do that this time around. Justin, I heard something about you, that you logged 500 caves in 1 year.
Yes.
How does one do that? That's more than one a day.
Oh, I mean, you set it as a goal and then you do that and nothing else.
So you were like, I'm gonna do 500 this year.
Well, I didn't do 500 caves. I discovered 500 caves.
Well, okay, yeah, you're right. So you found 500 caves. All in Tag, I'm assuming?
All in Tennessee.
All in Tennessee. These are new.
Yep.
So so Tennessee now has, what's the count in Tennessee, the approximate count?
It's over 11,000 now.
Now, so it was around 10 and a half before you started working.
That's right.
I'm sure that some of them
are small and some of them are significant. What are some highlights from that list? And when did, first of all, when did you do this?
Hold on, is this, this isn't a ploy to interview me, is it?
It might be. We didn't all like plan this or anything like that. And this is
you guys that conspire together.
But I am very curious. When did you do that? When did you, I guess, wrap this 500 cave? So
that was 2019 to 2020. And the TCS year, the deadline for the submission of data is September 1st. So it was September to September 2019, 2020.
Okay, so you did this mid-pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, halfway through is when the pandemic really started. And that, I mean, I had to change some things, but it didn't really impact me all that much because, I mean, pretty much every day I'm just out hiking around in the woods, not contacting anyone.
So, I'm sorry, this was a goal that you'd set from the beginning, or you were just on such a tear that you were like, I bet I could do 500, maybe you're like halfway through it or something
like that? No, it was very calculated. So the year before, and basically the first year that I was caving, I started using LIDAR and I had found 74 caves in the TCS year. And then I kept statistics on all of that, and based on the geology and various things, and so I just kind of started playing around with them, and I just extrapolated out, you know, what could you do if you just did it for a whole year? And the number I came back with was 300. And I thought that's incredible. That's insane. You could find, like, I have the data, like, and it's very the interesting thing is it's very constant. And now this distribution of caves that you find over time, if you're following the same method, it follows like a bell curve. So there's variation in there, but it's pretty constant to a certain ratio. And so, yeah, I extrapolated that out, realized I could find 300 caves, and I thought, I mean, that's insane. Like, I owe it to myself to try to do this incredible thing.
Yeah.
And so that's what I set out to do. And then over time, you know, you get better. I mean, you're doing it every single day, 15 hours a day. You learn things, and if you're keeping stats, you know, you can compare directly, so it's not just what you feel is going on. You actually have the numbers to back it up, and then you can progress from there. So, yeah, eventually I changed my goal to, all right, I got to find 400. I know I can find 400. And then eventually it was like, if I push really, really hard, like, I could hit 500. So then that became the goal.
That's wild. Okay. All right. What were your parameters? What defined a cave in this case?
The TCS, the Tennessee Cave Survey standard for a cave, which is 50 feet long, 40 feet deep, or a 30-foot pit. Obviously, this is referring to, you know, a natural cavity in the ground.
So you just, if you found a pit, were you carrying vertical gear with you this whole time?
Yes.
Okay, so you had vertical gear. I was thinking maybe if you were able to just stand over the hole with a disto and shoot down or something.
No, I physically qualified everything by pushing it. And in 95% of cases, as far as you physically could.
Yeah.
Because most caves are duds. I mean, they're just really dinky small things that you can do in an hour or less, and there's really no reason to come back to them when there's so much more out there. So the most efficient thing was to just do it right then, write up a full report, and then turn in what you know and be done with it. And that's just how I operated.
So you named these two while you were doing them?
Yes.
Based on whatever was in your head at the time, or was whatever was around?
Yes, yeah. You have to get, you know, I mean, you're naming hundreds of caves. It gets pretty hard to come up with good names. So you just kind of leap onto anything that's unusual or slightly odd or whatever. I try not to really ever name caves after people. I just think it's kind of really short-sighted.
Yeah.
I mean, the cave is there for, you know, eons, and people are very transient. So, yeah, I just try to select something interesting about the cave or the terrain or whatever and just go with that. And sometimes it'll be tangential, like times two. Like, you know, you just take some idea and, like, run with it and find a synonym for that. And because it's, you know, there's 11,000 caves in Tennessee, so you don't want to use the same name either. So, you have to get kind of creative, I guess.
What are some highlights from that list of names off the top of your head?
Yeah.
Black Mirror, that was a
Yeah, I like Black Mirror Cave, Arrhythmia Cave. I would spend some time, if I thought the cave was a good cave, trying to come up with a good name. For a lot of the other ones, you just kind of pick something that you don't really care too much about. And then if you have a really particularly terrible cave, then, you know, you got to come up with a...
some horror hole name?
Yeah, but it can't just be horror hole. It's got to be something like... like, why bathe when you can cave? That was one.
So that was a wet one.
It was very wet, yes.
You have a bunch of terrible names, like, in stock that you've...
I do. I have a list on my phone of...
potential names.
Yeah, of names in the chamber just ready to unleash when I find... as well.
Yeah, what's a name that you have come up with that you can't wait to apply to a real cave?
Well, I can't give that away.
Oh, you can't give that away. You're right. All right, that was crappy of me to put him on the spot with that. Like, what if it never happens? What if it never happens?
What percentage of the caves when you were out ridgewalking that year were like 20 to 30 foot non-qualifiers that you pushed and tried to make qualify but didn't ultimately?
I mean, that's a lot. I mean. Probably hundreds. I mean, you go in tons of holes that just don't qualify.
All of which would qualify in Missouri.
all of which would qualify in Missouri.
Appreciable distance.
That's it? Appreciable?
Otherwise known as 20 feet.
Oh, but. Wow.
What would you say is the percentage of caves that you found that just barely qualified? You said it seemed to be the majority.
Well, I mean, the majority are dud holes. I mean, by that I just mean... you know, it's like a blind pit. I mean, a blind pit could be 80 feet. You know, that's well over the 30-foot mark, but it's still a dud, and very few people are ever going to go visit it just to visit an 80-foot pit. Mm. Unless it's like really...
unless you're in Indiana. I mean, maybe in Tennessee nobody would bother, but in Indiana that's significant.
Yeah. I mean, the context changes things a lot. And, you know, if it's in a convenient location or... has nice formations or whatever, but it would be interesting to plot that out. So there's only a handful, like maybe like four, that were exactly 50 feet long, and then there's maybe like five or so that were exactly 40 feet long, because you would expect statistically you to have almost as many 41 foot deep caves as 40 foot deep caves. Mm-hmm. and so on. The interesting thing is, if you look at the database, that's not what you see. You see a really high representation of caves that are exactly 50 feet long, which to me pretty obviously suggests that there's a large number that are less than 50 feet and they get reported as 50 feet long.
That smacks of fudging the numbers a bit.
Yeah, so there's a human element to the statistics that we have in the TCS survey. So they cluster around, you know, short length, and they kind of taper down to, you know, the longer it is, the exponentially less likely you are to find such a cave.
So was this an everyday thing, pretty much?
Yeah, so the ratio I ended up sticking with. So the first 2 months I was actually working. I didn't quit my job till October, or November, actually, 1st of November. Then from that point on, it was, I could never get away from the 1-to-2 ratio of 1 day spent basically working on the computer and 2 days in the field. You know, I'd go out for weeks and then have to spend a week writing up all the reports. Total over the year, it was, I think it was a little over 200 days I spent in the field, 100 days working at home, and then the first 2 months were, I was working a job full time.
What was it like when you would come across one that petered out just before it qualified? Was it a disappointing feeling, or was it just... part of the game?
I mean, it's just part of the game. I mean, and you definitely could get disappointed, and especially if it was like all day, like you're hiking all day and finding out this thing's only 30 feet long, or this thing's only 28 foot pit, you know, doesn't qualify, and then you get to one that's 48 foot long, and I mean, like, you can't accept it, because then it would just be all meaningless if you cheated. So I mean, it just is what it is, and you move on. And then now here's the interesting thing. Okay, so I mean, in a lot of cases you can see some way of potentially continuation, and you just make it happen. Like, you just dig or hammer or whatever.
I was going to ask if you dug any.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. 20% of all the caves I found, I had to dig to qualify.
Okay.
And dig here is just like hand digging, you know, with the rock hammer and, you know, my hands, whatever I could move. But yeah, 20%. And yeah, you just do what you can to make it qualify. And the interesting thing that happens is you get to a point where there's some that are, it's almost like a really arbitrary decision on whether or not it meets the standard. Because it's like, all right, so this cave is, let's just say it goes in for 44 feet. And then off on the side, there's this like 6 foot long hole. So yeah, there's like 50 feet of passage right there. But
that counts?
Yes. And but that sounds really cut and dry the way I just explained it. But sometimes it's like, okay, is this really a separate passage or is it not? So then you just have to make a value judgment on whether or not it would really be, someone would really call this that. I mean, if it's not at least a body length long, I would not call it a distinct passage. And so it wouldn't be added in the total. And then
so you're setting you're like going by your own set of protocols as well, obviously. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I try to be very conservative. I wouldn't be satisfied with myself if I felt like I had put a cave in there that didn't qualify by reasonable standards. And then I also was worried, like, if you claim that you found 500 caves in a year, there's going to be, I would think, a large amount of scrutiny to that claim. And so the last thing I would want is someone to go in there and say, ah, this is totally bogus. So, yeah. So, I mean, I was conservative with my length estimates.
Yeah. You've got points on all of these. You've turned all of these in.
That's right. That's all in the database. Anyone can see the coordinates for it and go to the cave. And there's a,
well, not anyone.
Well, who has access to the TCS data, which is pretty open survey, can visit the cave and see for themselves.
What would you say are among the more significant ones that you found?
So Black Mirror is a cool cave. It's a little over 2,000 feet long. The interesting thing about that one is it's really accessible physically to most people. So a lot of these caves I found were, you know, have a really tight entrance or something, which is why no one had gotten into it before. But this one is, you pretty much right away you're in this really nice sized room, and then you go through this crack and you're in this room that's almost 200 feet in diameter, really nice rotunda room. It's got nice formations in it. So yeah, it's just very easy, horizontal cave. Almost anyone could visit. And yeah, it's just beautiful. So that was exciting. There's a few hundred footers I found that year. Voodoo Abyss was interesting. That was a highlight. That was kind of terrifying. It has this ledge at the top where you crawl out on this balcony over the pit, and then, you know, you rappel down from this balcony, and you get over the lip, and you realize that it's a slab that's only like 2.5 feet thick. And it's like 30 feet long, 20 feet wide. And it's just suspended over this pit by like nothing. Like, you look at the edges of it, and it's not like it's cantilevered in there. Like, obviously it must be, but it must be by some tiny fraction. Like, there's nothing underneath it. It's just sitting in the wall. And like, you can go around this balcony, and like, there's just a crack all the way around it.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's...
Is that what inspired the name?
Yes, Voodoo Abyss. It's because it's held up there by black magic.
Can you tell me a story about like a big rock that almost fell down on you in a pit? Is that the one you were describing?
Well, there's been a few of those. I mean, yeah, there's a few close calls throughout the year. Nothing I care to get into.
Yeah, all right. So we don't need to get into that, I guess. Although that does make good campfire talk, though.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's only if there's some element of sensationalization, which I don't really do. I mean, like, I nothing permanently bad happened, which I'm fortunate and grateful for, and so there's really nothing to say. I mean, like, oh, this rock shifted and I almost fell, you know, 20 feet, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that perspective. But how much of this would you say was solo versus with a team, small team or something?
It was essentially all solo. There was two caves I found with a person.
Oh, wow. So 498 by yourself.
Well, 500 by myself, two with a person.
502, of course.
Well over 500 for
the year. Well, there's a couple other ones I found and I didn't turn in because it was obvious people were working on the cave actively and didn't want to kind of spoil their first explorer's prerogative, I guess, if you will. Or
yeah. Was that our exit?
Yep. Sorry, guys.
That's all right.
You're zoning into this interview.
This is a live
pod. podcast. I'm like, this is great. I don't need to pay attention.
That's why we missed our exit.
Stories.
Now, were any of the caves that you turned in just so happened to be that somebody else in Tennessee turned in the same cave that year? Because I know that you didn't even accept the data for new caves that were turned in throughout the year to avoid any duplications, because you thought that was cheating.
Yeah, so there's a few instances where I turned something in, and Gerald informed me that it had already been turned in that year. And then there was two instances where I turned it in, and it came to light after the fact that it had also been turned in that year. That happened in two cases. So, yeah, that
you quoted those from your total?
Yeah, so then it actually becomes just 500 that are actually new submissions to the TCS for the year. So, yeah, exactly 500, I mean, it is what it is, but...
You know what the previous record is for any submission for one person in one year prior to that?
Previous record? What the previous record might have been for an entire year?
I don't know. Marion Smith mentioned to me when I found 74 that I had almost found, or it was close to what he had found in one year, which I imagine is probably the record, but I don't know what that is.
Man. See, you crushed what you absolutely destroyed what may have been the record. So, like, this is... It's going to take a long time for anyone to even come close, I think, to this. And I know that this was a personal goal of yours and not like a goal for glory or anything, but there's still got to be a bit of a glory element to it, right?
Well, I mean...
Your modesty is endearing as hell, I got to tell you.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, I don't really personally frame it that way. I mean, if I'm just being totally honest, I mean, there's days where I think about what I did and I feel inspired about it because I know the work and the dedication and the drive. I mean, when I was doing that, like I knew when I was out there in the woods doing that every day, there were days where it was like that thing, that spark, that thing that sets humans apart from all other animals, that really makes us distinct, that thing you have to have, like, I had it, like, and I knew it, like, I knew I wouldn't be able to ever duplicate it or replicate it, that this was my one shot in life to do this sort of thing, because it had never been done before. That's what was so important to me, is, like, I could go out there again and try to, and maybe with all the knowledge I've accrued and with a bunch of pre-planning, I could find 600 caves in a year. But that has no appeal to me because it's just redoing the process that you've done before. Like, you could just arbitrarily try to redo the same record over and over again. But, like, this, it was totally unknown. No one had ever done... I had never done anything on this scale. And it was like... And that's what's really fulfilling about it to me. Is like, so, like, why do you explore caves at all? Like, you explore caves because... You're pushing into the unknown. You're discovering new information and bringing it back to society. It's the going out into the unknown, into the bringing back of knowledge is like the hallmark of our species. So why not do that? Like, so you can do that with caving exploration, but then you can also do it in the way, the specific implementation of it. So like what I was doing with this is not only was I exploring physical places that had never been explored before, but I was doing it in such a manner that had never been done before. Mm-hmm. So it was novel in every sense of the word, like to me anyways. That's how I thought about it, and that's what inspired me to do it and drove me every day.
Yeah.
And when you have that sort of external purpose, you can push through anything. Mm-hmm. And you can essentially do anything within the realm of physics. Like that's your only limit, is the laws of physics.
That's really cool.
Where that boundary is so much further than what most people think, because most people don't dare to push themselves that far. But you're worried about, you know.
I think a lot of things you learn as you get older, that a lot of things make sense on paper, and then when you start doing it, it's a lot harder, or you realize these other limitations that you hadn't considered before.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is a lot of those limitations are totally arbitrary.
Like, yeah, you're right.
If you set a goal and it's truly your goal and nothing else matters, then you can go so much further past what most people do.
Yeah. obviously, in order to be able to do this, you had to have had experience going into it. How many caves had you found before this, before you started on this journey?
76.
Okay, so, wow. So you went from 76 whole career to 500 in 1 year.
Yeah, so when I started this, I had been caving just a little over a year. So I caved for a few months, found two caves, hiking around with Gerald. And then the next year, I went out and found 74 caves, and then I went out and did this.
And you were like, this is cave year. Yeah. We're going to do it.
Yep.
Wow. Were you looking in one area, like one mountain or one ridge or one? I mean, like, I know that there are some places in Tennessee where it's just like, hey, there's a cave, there's a cave, there's a cave, there's a cave. Was it like that, or did you have several different locations that you were kind of cycling through?
The latter, several locations. Now, most of it was in the same physiographic province, which is the Cumberland Plateau Escarpment.
Okay.
But that ranges all over, so we're looking at it right now in front of us. There were counties, so my single biggest county was Overton County, which was 151, I think, that year, that were strictly from that county. And that's due to a variety of reasons, but you couldn't limit yourself to just one small area. You had to be just using the LIDAR data and the TCS data, figuring out where there were gaps that had been overlooked by cavers over the year, and just picking from among all those spots and figuring out, you know, and also juggling access and how you're going to get to these places. And you're just making a series of value judgments to get what you think are the best results. But I didn't. So an interesting thing, like you could often predict, like looking at the LIDAR features. So like I'm looking at the LIDAR data, I'm identifying all these, I'm making a list, I'm grouping them together, and then I'm going out and I'm checking them. And you could often predict what your highest, you know, the most likely points were to be a cave. But I didn't just go for those, because I knew that if I did that, I would run out of points to check very quickly. And it varies by geology, but basically the Cumberland Plateau geologies, the limestones there, anything that would physically show up as a sinkhole on the LIDAR data that's available in Tennessee had a significant chance of being a cave. And so I just checked all of those.
Okay. And how many points were there that you checked and ended up at this number 500?
It was, I have all this in a spreadsheet. Off the top of my head, it was around 8,000.
Wow.
40, 50 a day.
So, all right.
Yeah, so 40 a day would be 8,000 over 200 days. So
That brings me to this question that I've been wanting to ask. Did you at any point have a day where you're up to speed, you're in trail shape, essentially. It takes a while to get to that point where you can do so much in a day. Did you ever track a big day as far as miles hiked, and then what was that number?
The most I ever did in a day, I think, was 13 miles, which is really not that much.
Yeah,
because that's not really the objective. Like, if you're doing a lot of miles in a day, then you're not finding caves.
But 13 miles of ridge walking is, I mean, like, you can do a 13-mile hike on a well-maintained or well-trodden trail, and it's going to be a less intense 13 miles than 13 miles of ridge walking.
Yes. No, that's certainly right. I mean, you take logging roads when you get the opportunity, but all in between that is just the woods, and the vegetation varies a lot. I mean, there's a lot of times where you have clear cut that's been logged, and you're just battling your way through briars and whatever. Generally, I would just take the shortest path between all the points in the cluster that I had set out to do that day.
So you've got LIDAR points, you've got these objectives. You're not just walking around in the woods at a certain elevation.
Right, and that's the key. So that's the key to all of this, is it needs to be, you have something and it's reproducible. And it's, okay, if you go out and you check X number of sinkholes, and there is a ratio that is specific to every geology. And it varies tremendously by the person who's doing it, because if you're less thorough or don't push yourself as hard, your ratio is going to be different. So that you can't just take this ratio and apply it yourself and expect the same result. So it's not really scientific in that sense, from a broad application perspective. But individually, as long as I was using the same selection methodology while I'm selecting the points, and then if I'm doing the same thing in the field, then the ratio was consistent. And then that's what allowed you to, you know, allowed me to make these predictions. But so now you have something where it's like, okay, if I check 16 points, I will find 1K for every 16 points. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this sub-ratio where because you find caves that are not those points, so along contacts and just quote-unquote randomly, the ratio is actually 1 in 12. So, okay, what that means is if I check 12 points a day, I will find 1 cave. So then the goal simply becomes check as many points as possible. So you don't need to think about anything else. That's the key, is you do all this work beforehand on the computer at home in a comfortable setting, and then when you get out there, nothing else matters. Oh, there's this giant briar patch in the way. It doesn't matter. The next point is there. I have to get to the next point. So you just check the point, and then you check the point. Oh, it's 48 feet long. It doesn't qualify. It doesn't matter. You move to the next point, and you just you come up with this system that it's just very simple, and you just execute.
Frustration had to have gotten in the way a few times, though. I mean, it seems like you're a very left-brain kind of person, where it's just like, okay, this, then this equals this, and let's go, let's do it. But you're also a human being.
Yeah, but I mean, the only time I really felt frustrated was when you had to make some sort of arbitrary distinction, and where you felt, like I talked about earlier, where it's like...
That's a great point.
Where, yeah, like, because I know, like, there's this bias internally that's like, I want to call this a cave, but I also don't want to compromise my principles. So it's, you know, and then, yeah, so you have to try to make this objective judgment of does this qualify or does this not. Those are the only times where I was really, remember being, feeling frustrated.
Well, yeah, there had to have been points where you found something that was just... not quite big enough, but maybe like when you got in there, it looked, I don't know, maybe there was some kind of formation or something, and you're like, well, that looks cool. Clearly this wouldn't happen anywhere but in a cave, right? Why can't we just call this a cave?
Oh, no, that happens so much and so frequently, especially at the beginning. Like, you just get used to disappointment. Like, just because it looks good at the start doesn't mean it's going to qualify. That wasn't the frustrating thing to me. It was when it does qualify by these standards, but it doesn't have the quote unquote spirit of a cave. It's like, okay, it's this pit, but it's like it's really wide and you can see the sky the whole time. It's 30 feet deep. Is this really a cave?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I feel compelled to log it. I mean, like, you have to make every one count every single day. That's the only way you get to 500. And it fits the, you know, quote-unquote textbook definition of a cave in Tennessee, but it feels bogus. So you have this kind of internal debate with yourself, and those were the things that were frustrating.
I think you have the right, you've earned the right to comment on this. If you were to change the definition, what would it be?
I think the definition in Tennessee is pretty good. I mean, talking with other people, they tend to get the numbers confused a lot because you have three different standards for three different measurable qualities. Most states don't have that. It's just like, it's 50 feet long or 50 feet deep. So I might simplify it like that, but I think the standard is pretty good. The standard in Tennessee is a lot more conservative than anywhere else I've seen. In Georgia, it's 30 feet of any length total. So it's like, if it's 20 feet deep and then 10 feet long, I guess it qualifies. I could be wrong on that, but yeah, most other places are a lot more liberal with their definition of a cave. So I like the Tennessee standard.
I think that the Tennessee standard fits Tennessee for sure.
Yes, yeah.
When you consider that, you know, it's the state with the most caves, you might as well set a strict standard.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Otherwise, you'd have 5,000 more things that really are significant in any meaningful way to cavers.
Yeah.
How many of the, like, dud caves that you found are interesting potential blowing holes, blast dig leads, things like that you put a note to go back to? Any?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a list of like 20 or so that are potentially worth going back to.
That didn't qualify?
No. Oh, no. Those are among ones that qualified. Ones that...
Any just like entrances that were too tight that you couldn't even get into
Good leads. Yeah, good leads. It's not digitized. I'd have to go through all my paper field notes. There's probably 30 or 40 of those that I marked on my notes that are worth going back to. But, yeah, I can't remember any off the top of my head because you've got going cave. You know, I mean, cave leads are a dime a dozen. But, yeah, there's still potential out there, obviously.
Well, I think we're almost there, and we'll keep this going.
That was what I was on.
Yeah,
just obviously.
The oak tree, yeah.
Justin was saying.
That's what Jim rigged to, which he says keeps it drier. Mm-hmm. That's what most people rig to, what I can tell.
Is that a new rope?
Yep.
Here we are at Connolly Hole. All right, I'm going to go rappel. Yeah, I'm clipped in here. Thank you for asking, though. All right, here we go. Been a while. I'm a little anxious. Here we go. Oh, here comes the old drippy drip. Woo! Whoop. Oh, beautiful. Wow. Whoa. Woo. I'm spinning. Off rope!
Look at this, though.
What you got? Is that me?
Yep. That's a pretty good... That one's a little bit...
Ooh, hazy, that's good, though.
I'll send all these to you.
Oh, thank you. That's red.
Yeah. I think that one's good with, like, the darkness around it. Such a pretty pit.
It is. This is gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, this is definitely not as big as the rumble room. So when you get into the rumble room, you're going to be like, holy...
You been there?
Yeah.
And you're coming down into it, right?
You're coming down into it. And it's the beginning of the through trip. Yeah.
It's the beginning?
So you're going to go through all this canyony, like crawling, and you're like squished up in mud, the bottom of the canyon or stemming on the top of the canyon. And then boom, the canyon just opens up to like dead black air. So 200 feet down, and then you get in a river. So you have to wetsuit it in the river for maybe an hour. And then you get out at something called Gary's Chamber, and then you have a whole nother experience of, like, some dry section. Oh, and then there's all these offshoots. That's another thing. Corey went with some friends, and I was supposed to go to that, and I wasn't able to go. But he went off of, he got out of the river. I think it's called the Lamb's Trail, where there's all this white, sparkly, fluffy, he'd be able to tell you what it is. But you're just basically, like, tiptoeing in a line, like, trying not to touch anything, with all this beautiful white mineral around.
Yeah.
It looks so pretty. So I definitely, when I go back, hopefully this year with a group of friends, like, we'll be able to hit all the things.
That's cool. This is gorgeous right
here.
Yeah,
like, looking at all these little...
Look at all this.
All the drip marks.
I wonder what's going on here. Like, is this...
I assume somebody... Oh, that?
Is this old flowstone, or is that a big chert ball?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What is going on there?
Yeah. I need to, like... I'd love to... You know, read some more rock books, do some more of my own research of figuring out. That's just neat that you know, you're able to accumulate so much information just being underground. And
yeah.
There's so much I don't know that I'm so interested about. I feel like I'm.
Okay!
I feel like I'm constantly, what's that? What's that about? What's that? That looks neat. I want to find out about that.
Rope
went down pretty zippy. I guess I can see it's a new rope, it's a spin.
Yeah. I usually, with this micro rack, I usually need to use the hyper bar, and I did eventually when I got about halfway down.
Yeah.
I threw it on the hyper bar, but I needed to take it off to get anywhere when I was at the top, and that made me nervous because I don't cave very often, A, and B, you know, vertical is even less often.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, this brook felt zippier on my bob, and I'm always like, on, bobbity bob. This one, I was moving. I was like, okay, good.
Everybody's into the bobbins now. You got to stop, or is that a basic?
It's a basic.
Yeah.
Well, it's a simple. It's a simple. The basic is the.
Or simple, rather. Simple. Yeah, simple.
Yeah, I learned on the simple, and I guess who taught me? She did a lot of alpine caving, which is you're doing a rebelase constantly. So that was something that was a pretty huge benefit compared to a rack, which is super cumbersome if you're going to do alpine, any sort of alpine caving.
Hmm. Who was it that taught you?
Rachel Saker.
Oh, Rachel.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. So she was like, she's really awesome to be like, girl, you want me to show you? Come on.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate her for that.
There he is.
Stop right there.
You're on the record. You just came down Connolly Hole. How do you feel?
Fantastic.
Oh, bro!
Toad! Or frog.
Yeah.
Oh, you saw him already. Climbing the flowstone to get to the register. There it is. There it is. Oh no, it's all wet. It's all full of water. Somebody left it open. Well, I'm on the register, but it is very soggy.
So I don't know if you heard the story, but there used to be like a winch system where they would lower people down back in the early 1900s.
Here?
For 5 cents, you could take a ride down Conley Hole.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
That's what they have in the TCS narrative. Perhaps it could be folklore, but that sounds a little bit believable.
Wow.
And apparently there used to be like metal scrap pieces of whatever was left of it that you could see.
No refunds. Oh. This is what I keep seeing.
That clear crystal stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if that's quartz.
This is, yeah, I mean, it's got to be something like that. I kept seeing it coming up the hill, too.
Justin would probably know.
It's heavy. Justin, what is this stuff?
It's chert.
This is chert?
Yes.
Yeah, I always associate chert with being black.
It comes in many very varied colors. It just depends on the mineral impurities that are in it, because chert is just silica, the same mineral as sand and glass.
Getting ready to climb out. I'm gonna roll tape. I'm rolling tape.
Part two.
Should we do part two? Are you down for part two?
I guess so.
First of all, how was that pit?
It was beautiful.
That was a good time.
Yeah. Not too much water, which I appreciated.
That was that nice little drip right next to it. I could just reach out.
It was cooling.
A little drippy drip on my hands. Did you go to Alaska?
Yes.
What was... Is there some hesitancy there? Talk about that?
Well, I mean, it's just... Where do I start?
What did you do there?
Well, I went out and I went to an area that I thought hadn't been worked and tried to find some caves.
Did you find any?
Yes, I found 38... I got in contact with Kevin Allred after the fact, found out that about a dozen or so he had documented already, but it was still a productive trip and just something I plan to go back to.
Where was it?
So it's in southeast Alaska in the Alexander Archipelago. Yeah, it's outside of the Tongass National Forest, which is where historically most of the work in southeast Alaska has been done. I couldn't get access to really any sort of survey data, and that there's not really a survey per se in Alaska. And so without that, I just had to go off of publications that I could find, search through, and just kind of do a little detective work to figure out what hadn't been worked. And this area, as far as I could tell, hadn't really been worked, and it also had LIDAR data. So I was able to use that to go out there and find caves.
How would you describe the terrain? Was it more or less challenging?
It's extremely rugged. I mean, it's just very steep. The mountains, like, come straight down into the ocean. It's very beautiful. the climate there is, it's a temperate rainforest, so it gets over 100 inches of rain a year, so it's very densely vegetated. And now this was an interesting thing. So there was times where you're like, you're climbing up the mountain and it's so much steeper than what you could ever do here in Tennessee, but you were able to climb it because the vegetation was so thick. If you just kind of envision a cat climbing a shag rug, like that's what I was doing. You just kind of stamp your feet into the moss, yeah. And there's these wild blueberry bushes everywhere, and they have these kind of wiry but stiff woody stems, and you basically have these like little ropes coming out of the hillside that you can use and just climb like up these hills that are like on a 45 degree incline.
Wow.
Exposed, like you had to hold on for your life, or was it all pretty in control?
There was, when I was getting up one mountain, there was some cliffs that I had to navigate up, which were pretty exposed and pretty unnerving, but you know, you just kind of take your time and figure it out and get up there. And then I was worried about being able to find my way back, because you get up there and you're at like the top of the cliff and it's super vegetated, and then you continue up the mountain, but you have to find your that specific one spot that you can climb back down again. But I mean, it all worked out.
You said you found 38 caves. Is the qualification different there?
Yes, it's a lot more lax than Tennessee, but I couldn't. That's just based off the publications I've read, but there it doesn't seem to be like a real definition of cave there,
yeah.
Any sort of dimensions or anything, so I just use the Tennessee standard.
Okay, so everything you found would qualify as a cave in Tennessee too?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. You found other things though that would maybe qualify under Alaska standards though, you think maybe?
Yeah, there would be quite a bit more, but this particular area was covered in a lot of epikarst, basically just a highly porous zone of surface rock. And so there's just fractures and cracks everywhere that have been solutionally enlarged. And it's kind of overwhelming with, like, you have to draw a line somewhere. I wouldn't really want to personally go any more liberal of a definition than what you use in Tennessee, just because otherwise you'd be documenting hundreds of things that just don't go anywhere.
Right. On the one hand, it's a strict definition, but on the other hand, it's like, yeah, if you're in a rich area, you've got to kind of rein it in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you there again?
Just under 2 weeks was the trip, and it was 10 days in the field. I flew into Juneau and then took a ferry from there to a small town, and then from there I hired a charter boat to drop me off where I needed to get to. I was there for 10 days and then got picked up on the boat again.
Just out there all alone for 10 days?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Grizzly bear territory, right?
Yeah, there's brown bears there. Fortunately, I didn't see one. I did see one black bear 80 feet away, but, you know, they're not too bothered by you.
The evidence of a grizzly, like, as soon as you landed?
Yeah, so, I land on the beach.
Oh, man.
I hop out of the boat, you know, I make my way to the wood line, and I'm not even 50 feet in, and I see this massive pile of bear scat, and it's so huge it could only have come from a brown bear. So it's like, all right, great, you know, this is great. This
day one.
Yeah, right away we get, you know, all right. So I walk a few yards further and I come to this animal trail, like it's game trail, and just huge like depressions in it that I can only assume are from bear feet. And then I walk down that 50 feet and there's this big log that has fallen across the trail, and the top of the log where it intersects the trail is wet on top. So that means some animal with a wet belly had just crossed over this log. So yeah, at that point I made a 180 degree turn and walked straight back to the beach and hiked a mile or so until I found a location I thought was less likely to have so many bears around.
Did you know where you were looking? Or, I mean, obviously you can identify karst terrain, and mm-hmm. so you know to go there versus there. But did you do the whole thing that you had done sort of in Tennessee where you had LIDAR data and you're like, okay, there's an objective?
Yes. I did a lot of pre-planning. So, I mean, I narrowed it down kind of by karst geology that coincided with LiDAR coverage and also hadn't been worked before, as I described earlier. And then from there, I mean, you deal with actual LiDAR data itself. Like, you look at it, and, like, you either see that, okay, it looks great or it looks terrible. And it looked great, but it looks different than Tennessee. So there, I mean, there's a gamble there. Like, am I going to get there and just totally strike out? I don't know, but, I mean, that's the risk you take. So I identified about 400 points that I thought were the most interesting looking ones, kind of broke them down into sections and what I thought was a reasonable amount of terrain to cover in a day, just kind of planned things out. And I knew I wouldn't be able to get to all the points, so I kind of had it broken down where, all right, I'll check this mountain for the first couple days, and then regardless of what I find, I want to move on to this next mountain, just because this is really kind of more of a reconnaissance trip. Mm-hmm. Anyways, yeah, the first couple days, I basically found nothing. I found one small cave, and then this summit of this mountain that was just covered in sinkholes. None of them had caves. I'm not entirely sure why. I'm not sure if it was too low elevation, and so it was covered in, like, a valley glaciers and scoured, and what had been exposed hadn't had enough time to be exposed to solution. It also, a part of it, I think, is because of the soil cover there was a lot higher, and so any little entrances were filled with soil potentially. But in any case, I moved on to the next mountain and had much better luck there. The terrain there is really, it's very alien. It feels like you're on this another planet. It's every day was overcast, and most of the time it was just raining and windy, and it's gray, and you're on this, like, almost black rock that just undulates as far as you can see with these strange karst landforms and very little vegetation. It feels like you're on an alien planet.
Which is cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool to see. What did you find most of? Was it a lot of horizontal? Was it vertical? Was it a mix?
It's mostly vertical. There's a large percentage that are just
pits.
Just pits. There was a few that you could climb down, and I would climb down a little ways, and a few of them were just short caves, which I documented. A few of them would climb down a little ways and come to a pit. And I expect, in typical fashion for caves everywhere, it seems, is most of the pits are probably going to be blind. But you never know. And the depth potential here is pretty high by U.S. standards, so that's why I'm interested in this specific locality. I didn't have anything to rig to on the surface while I was there because it was either a smooth monolith or the rock was highly frost-shattered. And I didn't have the equipment to really deal with that. So, yeah, I mean, I really have to go back to find out what most of these pits are going to do. There was one that had at least a 100-foot rock fall. That's kind of the one I'm most intrigued by, but
was the rock different from what you're used to?
Yeah, it's different than Tennessee. It's highly metamorphosized. It's basically marble.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was beautiful. The pits that, you know, you would see where it's cut through the rock and you have this white and black banding is pretty beautiful.
Educate me. I mean, is marble metamorphized? Is that the word? Limestone, typically?
Yes. I think the word is actually metamorphosed.
Metamorphosed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just limestone that has been subjected to heat and pressure.
Yeah.
I'm really not entirely sure what the distinction is. I mean, it's still calcium carbonate. I don't think it undergoes, like, a chemical transformation. Maybe it's just the crystal structure that changes. I really don't know.
Snowing when you were there?
No, but there was a lot of snowpack that was just stays year-round on the mountain, and the majority of the pits had snow in them. So just because the snow falls in there, and then it's just in the shade all the time, and it just never melts.
Did you get a temperature reading on what temperature it is in the caves there?
I did not.
What would you estimate?
Where you're around snowpack, I mean, it's got to be right around freezing,
yeah.
I would assume. If you look at the climate data from there, the average cave temperature should be warmer than that. It should be probably in the low 40s, I would guess, but I really don't know.
I'm very curious because you were there in the field for 10 days. Obviously, you're camping, and you brought a lot of gear with you, right?
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, I went with, like, ultralight principles, but my pack weighed over 80 pounds because of the amount of rope I had and vertical gear and caving equipment. I was prepared to scout out caves, but I ended up transitioning to more of a more surface reconnaissance role, you know, as the trip progressed due to the rigging issues, and I decided that the benefit really wasn't worth it. I would just try to focus on covering the most ground as possible. But yeah, so I had a lot of rope, just an ultralight tent, and just camping on the mountain.
Did you plan to forage for a lot of food, or did you make sure to bring enough food to sustain you for that period?
I brought enough food to sustain me. I mean, if you're foraging for food, you're not finding caves.
Right, that's true. But you mentioned the blueberry bushes, so I didn't know if maybe you counted on eating blueberries too.
I did not count on that. It was just kind of an opportunistic foraging. I did do some of that. Like, as I'm hiking around, you know, you stop to catch your breath, like, oh, I'll pick some blueberries off and eat them. So, yeah, that was kind of cool. That's the first time I've really done anything like that. But, no, I prepared all my food beforehand, and I basically just stole from the chapter, in the Cheve 2021 expedition report. There's a chapter by Sean Lewis where he goes into like expedition nutrition and just dealing with the logistics on like big cave expeditions. You know, reducing weight and bulk is paramount.
Right.
So he has a lot of great information in there, and I took that and I kind of tailored it to my specific taste and wants and nutritional requirements. And so, I mean, you've got this breakfast mix and a dinner mix that's made of dehydrated components that are very high in macros, so that being, like, you know, fat, carbs, and protein. So you're not carrying any water weight, and then you and there's water everywhere in Southeast Alaska, so then you just collect some water, boil it, and you have hot breakfast and dinner every day. And then I had a dried fruit and nut mix that I used for day food. That was key to reduce weight as much as possible. I mean, 10 days of food is pretty heavy.
Yeah. What was the dinner mix? Like, what did you eat?
Well, there's ramen, instant potatoes, dried hummus, TVP, which is textured vegetable protein, dehydrated vegetables, probably a couple ingredients I'm forgetting, but and a little bit of, like, powdered tomato and parsley, which kind of round out the vitamin profile. And originally I had Parmesan cheese and like bacon bits in there. I ended up cutting both of those out. The bacon bits, because the particular brand I had tend to spoil after a few days, but and also it has a pretty strong smell, and I was trying to eliminate smelly foods due to the bears.
Yeah.
And then the Parmesan cheese, even though it's like dry cheese, it really makes it a lot harder to clean the cookware when you're done, and I didn't want to have to deal with residue on the cooking material due to the bears, so I ended up cutting that out as well.
This might seem to make all the sense to you, but for someone who doesn't do this kind of thing, it's just kind of fascinating to me. You thought of everything.
Well, luck favors the prepared.
Yeah. You considered everything, you thought of everything, and that's how you did it. Now, me, I'm like ready, fire, aim. You would hate to go on an expedition with me.
I mean, you're going out solo in the Alaska wilderness for 10 days. Like, you need to know, you know, what you're doing. You need to be prepared. You need to be prepared for when things go wrong. So, yeah, I mean, it's not something to be taken lightly. But if you plan it out beforehand, then, you know, the risk is pretty well minimized. But yeah, it ended up being, I should have rebalanced the meals after I took the cheese and the bacon out, because I didn't have enough protein.
How did you know that you didn't have enough? Were you fatigued or anything?
Yeah, so this is something I've kind of noticed over the years of kind of endurance activities, I guess. You just get this feeling, and like, you know what your body, like when you're pushing pretty hard all the time, like, you know what you're capable of, you have an expectation for what your body can give you. And so when it starts not to do that, it's typically correlated with something. You know, maybe it's not enough sleep or whatever. But yeah, if I'm not getting enough protein, my legs just feel weak and they feel just tired. And like the rest of me feels fine, like my brain is alert or whatever. But like my legs just don't have the power that they're supposed to. And then so like you'll go and you'll, you know, eat a bunch of protein and get a good night's sleep and you'll feel great because your body breaks down that protein and fixes your muscles that you are degrading every day. So yeah, I mean, when I got out from the field and I was hiking around or just walking around Juneau, you know, seeing the city before I flew out, and I had to walk, there's some steps around the city, like I guess kind of like an overpass, like a pedestrian overpass thing, and you go up like two flights of steps and like I could barely make it up the steps. Like I'm like completely winded, my legs are like shaking. It's like I was just climbing a mountain like 2 days ago and now I can barely walk up some steps. So yeah, I mean, proper nutrition makes a huge impact.
It's just so cool that you've done this in Tennessee and Alaska. I think you mentioned, but what was it that made you want to do the Alaska thing?
Well, for me, I'm looking for depth potential, and the area there has some of the greatest depth potential in the U.S.
Yet, mostly what you found were about 100 footers, maybe?
Well, yeah, that's just the entrance pit. I mean, I don't know what is going to happen.
Good point.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily have to have some huge open-air pits to have a deep cave. I mean,
yeah, it's like what they found out in the Bob Marshall, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all... And that's cold, too, there. So it only makes sense that the freeze-thaw would kind of make things a little different at the top, I guess. I don't really know. I mean, I don't have the experience, but...
What is the depth potential? How many thousands of feet?
It's probably a little under 3,000 feet at this particular mountain. So, yeah, that's what has me intrigued.
Are there any caves that are at, like, the base of the mountain that are known?
No. There is some springs, and there is one spring about... 600 feet of elevation, which is about 2,800 feet below the summit that I know of. It's just so large, you can see it with LIDAR. You can actually see it with satellite imagery. I mean, it's one thing to have 3,000 feet of elevation with limestone on it. Where exactly the water is going to resurge is an open question. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you can have caves that are that deep there. But yeah, the potential's there, so the only way to know is to go.
You gonna go?
Yeah, the plan is to head back this summer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You've got specific ones in mind? Of course you do.
Yes.
You bringing a team?
Yeah, a small team.
How much time do you plan to spend?
Probably about the same amount of time, maybe, depending on the logistics and figuring out travel. Things are weird there because you have to take a boat or a plane to get anywhere, and so figuring all that out ahead of time, I mean, it puts like a constraining factor on the days that you can do. But yeah, about 2 weeks or less.
It'll be a completely different kind of trip too. You're not going to look. You're not going to look for caves. You're going to look through the caves you already found.
Yes. Yeah. We the way I have it planned out is we'd break up into two small teams, probably of two people each, or three. We would focus at the start on the caves that have been found and have the greatest potential by my estimation, while also checking. So, I mean, I learned a lot looking at the LIDAR, seeing things in the field, and then now I can take that knowledge and compare back to the LIDAR again. And as I said earlier, like the LIDAR, the way it manifests and on the computer, essentially, that you're looking at is different than here in Tennessee. So, but now I can kind of see some patterns in the field and then find other LIDAR points that I think have high potential. So there's some points that fit that description that I would also make a high priority to check while we're there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what we'd be doing we would be planning on surveying and exploring, you know, every pit that we go to. Mm.
You already got names picked out for some of these holes?
Some of them, yeah.
Do you think the names might change if you find anything significant? Or does that, I don't know what the ethics are there. Can you change it once you've already named it?
If you haven't published it, yeah, I would say so. Because it only really exists in your mind at that point.
Right, and here's a quick addendum to the conversation. We started talking about Justin's caving genesis, and I didn't turn on the recorder for about a minute or two once we got him going on that. And so we kind of just pick up in the middle of this.
I wanted to go to at least one cave on this trip. So we ended up stopping at Wind Cave in South Dakota and did the tour there. And I'm on this tour, and I knew several things. Like, I knew that, A, I did not belong on a tour, and B, I belonged crawling around, climbing around. it was just this realization that there's this whole world here, this to explore. And
literally explore, like find, be the first person to see.
Well, at that point, I probably not. It was just to see. It didn't really matter at that point whether or not someone had been there. It's just, there's this whole, I just wanted to see everything. I wanted to see where this went, where it goes. Like, there's just so much here on offer, and I don't need or want a tour guide. Like, I want to crawl and climb around. And it wasn't even like something you really even needed to articulate in your head. It's just, you knew that's where you belonged. And so from that moment on, it was like, all right, how do I get involved in this? Like, what is caving? Like, and you just start researching, and like, okay, you got to join a cave club, which is called a grotto. And, you know, that's how you get involved, and all these rules, you know, you can't cave alone, and three sources of light, whatever. So I researched all that. I was living in Georgia at the time, moved to Tennessee strictly for the caves, and I moved to Nashville specifically for work, because I do carpentry work, and I knew I could move and find carpentry work in Nashville, and the construction industry has been booming there for years. So yeah, and then I went to a Nashville Grotto meeting, and I was very fortunate to meet Gerald Mone. So the next Sunday, we went out to this cave just south of Nashville. A couple things happened on that first trip. So we get into this one cave. It was only supposed to have one entrance. Well, I went up this crawlway and found another entrance to it. So it was like, okay, oh, this is super cool. Like, I found something new. And, you know, Gerald's documenting away. And we went to the main objective for the day, which was this cave. And we were going to survey with Ken Easer. So Ken and I go in there. And we spend like 4 hours in this cave surveying. And we come out, and like, you know, there's a stream down there, there's fish. This is my first wild cave, essentially. And, you know, we're down there for hours, and you climb out of the entrance is just this basically man-sized hole just in the flat ground. And so you chimney out like 15 feet, and I'm just standing there and afterwards in awe, just looking at this tiny hole. It's like a portal to a whole nother world. I mean, it was just... It was amazing, and I knew right then, like, this was it. This is what I was made for. Like, this is what I want to do. And so, and then from then, from that point, it was nonstop. It was every single weekend with Gerald, and I mean, I really consider myself fortunate for meeting Gerald, because we would just go out and we were checking caves that were in the database. And I mean, because that's the key point. You can't just go and explore this cave and come back and not document it. If you don't, then it essentially didn't happen as far as the universe is concerned. Mm-hmm. So that was the key, was seeing the TCS, the Tennessee Cave Survey, being able to contribute to that, to go out there, to have fun, to be physical, to push yourself, be somewhere no one has ever been before, and then bring that information. And, you know, sometimes we were checking a cave that was already known about, and so we're correcting the documentation about it, or we find something new, and you're bringing that back to the rest of the world. I mean,
so you were surveying on your first wild cave trip?
Yes.
And they just showed you how to do it?
Yeah, Ken showed me how to do it, but that was just so cool to see the process, and then...
That's awesome. let me just say that it's... Having talked with you for the last, you know, few hours, it's kind of an honor to have gone with you on your first wreck trip.
Yeah.
Man, what an incredible feat. Really. I mean, what Justin did in Tennessee is something to be admired, and really, honestly, something to be modeled. Like, if you have access to your state's data and you know how to read it and you know how to use it, then there's no reason you can't do something similar, you know? Just amazing. Bravo, Justin.
And thank you to Justin and to Corey and Aaliyah for the great company on a great trip that Friday of Sierra Cave Fair 2023. I have more from Sarah, another trip that I took to Kegel's Chasm, another one that I've been wanting to go to for a long time. And I started an interview with Zeke McKee down there that he and I are planning on finishing very soon. So I got three good episodes out of that trip down to Caver's Paradise, and I'm very thankful for that. Thanks again to Alan, and thank you for listening. This has been the Caving Podcast. Support the podcast by supporting the sponsors, past and present. Current sponsor, Sophie Reaptress, gets you a cave suit, sophiereaptress.com, or click the link in the description. I've also been sponsored by Swago, swagogear.com, gets you one of those nice packs. Organic Robot Designs. If you've thought about making t-shirts for your grotto, Charlie will hook you up at organicrobotdesigns.com. Also, Elspelio Lights, which are now being sold by On Rope One. So yeah, good times. I'll see you at Indiana Cave Capers in August, but I'll be back in July with another episode. Which one? Is it going to be Zeke? Is it going to be Kegel's Chasm? I don't know, man. I haven't figured that out yet. But I will. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. Till next time, kill nothing but time.